I want to introduce you to someone I consider a friend and a mentor. And full disclosure, Andrew is also a client of mine as well. Uh-huh. We've known each other for 5 years, 6 years or so. And Andrew was one of the first people on our list of people to bring onto the podcast. I just thought it was really poignant that we have you here, Andrew, and talk, because Damien and I speak about leadership, and specifically leadership that's fearless and purpose-driven and vulnerable and open-hearted. And, you know, you're the logical person to have us sitting here. And Reg and Marita and Elizabeth, who's coming on, these people who we're so lucky to have in our lives, right? And the first thing that occurred to me, I was thinking, what are we going to talk about with Andrew? Because we speak often. And the natural thing is we always end up, we talk about our personal lives a lot, but then we talk about work. So we have to separate those two things in this conversation. So one thing I wanted to ask you is, you spent some time in Antarctica this year. And as a leader, I want to know, when you walked away from that experience, what did you learn about yourself?
I learnt that we play a significant role in the well-being of the planet that we don't understand. And we also, while we may consider at times being one of 7 or 8 billion people, that we may be insignificant in size ourselves, the impact that we can actually have on the planet, on its sustainability, and on future generations is amazing. I saw down there signs of what I considered to be environmental prosperity. Massive numbers of whales, massive number of seals, of penguins, of krill, of just purity. But then I saw the devastation of areas of lost ice shelf, the impact of climate change on how penguins feed. And it was really humbling, but gave me a real drive to understand what shadow I provide and what shadow I leave. And I think it's, how do we make the place better?
Yeah, you would have felt this small and I imagine at the same time profoundly useful as a human being.
Yeah, can I tell you the first 6 minutes?
Yeah. Go for it, please.
So I'm on a boat with my wife. We've woken up at 6 a.m. I've opened up the curtains and I've stepped out onto a balcony. It's minus something and I'm in bare feet. And I'm in awe because I'm looking at a sheet of ice which would be 4 kilometres tall.
Wow.
Then in front of me, about 1,000 penguins started to swim by. The boat had stopped at that stage, so we had no motor noise. We're in silence. Then what happened was a giant southern petrel. Wow. 2.4 metres. I thought it was a drone.
Yeah, wow.
What?
And then a whale breached and took probably 2 or 3 tonne of krill, all in the first 6 minutes. And then I realised my insignificance within the landscape. And the other thing is, it gave me an insight of what the world was probably like before humanity became what we are, because the animals are fearless of us.
Yeah, I can imagine. Mm. Just this oddity.
Yes. You know. And they didn't see us as a threat. They just saw us as a black thing in, you know, some sort of Gore-Tex.
Gore-Tex, yeah.
And they would just come up and look at us. Yeah, they weren't worried about us. The penguins were worried about the leopard seals.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
What was the inspiration behind that, Andrew? What was drawing you to go visit Antarctica?
Susie, my wife, and I had a desire to travel. That was our passion when we first met. So we've been working our way through the bucket list, and we had the opportunity to go to and learn from Africa. We've also gone to Antarctica, and I've also had the opportunity to go to Machu Picchu in South America. So if it was just to, firstly, to fulfil a travel bug, but it turned in more on that. It's actually to learn, particularly as, well, I'm privileged enough to have grandchildren, to be in a position of being able to learn from them and realise that we're just, you know, short-term custodians and something very much bigger than what we are. And if I may, I had an opportunity to travel on business over to West Africa to attend an international conference. And in that conference, I had the chance to talk to a professor who was a subsistence farmer for the in the country which I was, and he was talking to me about the United Nations Sustainability Development Goals.
Sure.
And I didn't know a lot about that. And he told me that what they are, amongst many things, is a risk heat map for humanity.
Yep.
Because if we get them wrong, he's saying that it will be devastating for the existence of mankind. The planet will be fine, because what will happen is we will disappear, the planet will turn into an acid soup, and it'll take, you know, 100 million years, and it will correct itself, but we just won't be around. So I found that was an eye-opener and a change of perspective and a lens, whether it's right or wrong, but it was just a lens which changed my thinking and behaviour.
Andrew, Jim and I talk a lot about transformative experiences and how we sort of go on these learning journeys. I can imagine coming back from Antarctica almost would have changed you again from the inside out, just to be amongst that environment. That's, I mean, it'd be hard not to feel affected and sort of opened.
Totally. You realise the enormity and fragility of Antarctica, the role that it actually places in cooling the planet, moderating the planet, but also feeding the planet, and the consequences if we get it wrong, and we are getting it wrong.
Mm.
And we need to ensure that we talk about climate adaptability and climate change, but we need to change our behaviour, because this is not a rehearsal. Yeah, it's very difficult to make the changes, and we've got to ensure that what we do is invest in what we do ourselves, what we do as a collective, but also I think this is an area where we need to show true leadership and invest in things which are, you know, multi-generational, and then our impact may be slow, but we need to do things now.
Yeah, and it sort of reminds me, I mean, it's how important it is for leaders to get the public and people and custodians emotively and experientially connected. Otherwise, it's going to feel abstract. It's like, oh, look, mate, it's over there.
It's so distant.
Yeah, it's so distant. You know, it's not really affecting me. Mm. Come on, let's be honest.
That's right.
So I think it just reminds you of just how fundamentally important it is for leaders to understand how to tell big stories,
It is for, because not everyone's going to step foot on Antarctica, right? So Andrew, you've been viscerally impacted by that. And how important it is for Andrew to use that experience, and it's almost an obligation, isn't it?
It certainly is. There are things which I've learned about Antarctica which I didn't know. I conveniently chose not to go and do the investigation and understand how much impact it has and it's the way in which it actually changes and moderates the planet. So when I read that there was 10,000 King Emperor penguin chicks that died because the ice shelf melted before their feathers were formed to a weatherproof layer, that emotionally affected me.
Yeah.
And I can remember listening to the radio, and it was a 10-second grab on a news item, and then they moved on to something frivolous and irrelevant. And I'm sitting there thinking, you don't know, you haven't been there, you don't know the actual impact of what that is. And there's a lot of science and a lot of research which is happening, and one of them which was really interesting for me is in Antarctica there's a lot of krill. Krill is critically important to feed obviously the animals up the food chain, the whales, etc. We go and farm krill so that we can take a krill tablet.
Mm-hmm.
If you take the krill out of the ecosystem, then the animals have to go somewhere else to feed.
Mm.
So for the convenience of the short term, we're actually stuffing up the long term.
Mm.
And I think, to me, that had a huge effect, because what happens is you go on a boat, you go past areas of nothingness, and then you'll see 200,000 penguins. Mm. And the reason why the penguins are in that spot and not another spot is because the underwater currents out there somewhere are pushing up the krill. And someone explained it to me is, it's like a supermarket. Mm. People live close to the supermarket and they know where the supermarket is.
Yeah.
That's what the penguins are doing. Mm. Climate change is moving the supermarket. So when they go, they've put trackers on penguins. When they go, they go out to where they used to be, but then they're searching for another 2-3 days to try and find where the supermarket is. So they use up all this energy and then they come back. So this is the impact. So there is a an amazing responsibility which I walked away from in not only telling the story but understanding the small impact, the big impact that our small actions take.
I've always felt that. I'm glad you said that, actually, because I've always... No, actually, that's a lie. I've recently felt that we have... Anyone with privilege, anyone with a position of leadership has an obligation to move the needle. And I'm starting to realise how important that obligation is. To use their privilege, use their platform, network, whatever you want to call it, those visceral experiences that, you know, in this room you've had and... I don't know. Damien and I probably won't have. I kind of feel that I've started to realise how important it is, and I almost expect people to use that privilege and obligation to move the needle to make this world a better place. And I'm glad you said that, because that for me is visceral. That for me is emerging as something, you know, when we watch the news, when we get sucked into this rabbit hole in the news as we normally do. I expect more from the leaders we're surrounded by.
I totally agree. I think if there is something which is out there, we've got the rise of nationalism. We've got geopolitical tensions, which I've only seen a couple of times in my lifetime. We've got a short-termism. We've got the rise of one particular stakeholder group over the community. So we're talking about shareholders. We talk about wealth creation rather than value creation. We talk about what's in it for me rather than what we can do as a collective. So I think we're not asking ourselves the right questions as leaders, and we're not doing it within the right time frames. And I don't think we're being honest with ourselves either.
That's why I like you, Andrew.
Thank you very much.
I really do. And that your comment about how so many people, sometimes we dehumanize the conversation when we talk about organizations. It's actually human beings who are in an organization. How many people make the decision to create value for shareholders as opposed to value creation for the communities and the world they live in, which includes shareholders, right? Let's be frank. We don't hear what you've just said very often.
No, well, for me, we've dumbed down the conversation. And as Dimitri, you know, we've taken a long step towards being honest and transparent with ourselves about the impact which we have through our investment decisions and what we do. And then we go away from just talking about output to outcome. And that outcome may not be immediately obvious or beneficial to us, but it creates a better society or a better community or a better capability that people can leverage off. So we always ask ourselves, what's the value that we're trying to create in the activity which we're undertaking? And we also ask ourselves, what's the value that we release by doing things differently and creating things differently? And we've had conversations about that in the past. But we also have to be honest about what value do we put at risk by actually doing some of our activities, whether that risk is borne by us or borne by the community or borne by future generations.
Yeah, of course.
And that, if there's one thing I think, well, there's many things that have happened to Andrew over my life journey, but the leader that Andrew Cairns is today is not the leader that I was when I was 20 or even 30 or 40. One of the things that I actually look at now, and I think it's a really important thing, is to see how we have that collective outcome. So what is the thing which you're looking to invest and improve the prosperity of the collective rather than the prosperity of the few?
Andrew, can I ask you a question? You mentioned that sort of your own transition as you sort of came through the world and, you know, in your 20s and 30s. You probably had a lot of turning points. Was there one defining turning point that you could talk about that kind of got you really thinking consciously about these decisions and choices? Was there something that you went through there, or was it a series of experiences throughout your life?
I'm often asked questions about how did you plan your career? I didn't. I've just lived my career.
Yeah.
Every time I changed jobs, I changed industries, which is very common today, but it wasn't common when I started my working environment. And I worked for a job for about 2 to 3 years, then changed. So I was exposed to many different managers, but only very few number of leaders.
Hmm.
So I had the opportunity to work for a gentleman by the name of Rob Hunt. Rob was the managing director for Bendigo and Adelaide Bank, and he developed the community banking model, which is a collective model whereby it's partnering banks with communities to be able to participate in the retention of capital in their community. Now, everyone will immediately think that that's financial capital, but it's not. The whole model is around how can you keep productive capital, human capital, intellectual capital, environmental capital, social capital in your community. And that, to me, was a real turning point because I have an engineering background, so I was in building things.
Okay.
And you built things that you could see, touch and feel. Whereas working with Rob, he had a few things which really resonated me. One, you can make a conscious decision to feed into the prosperity of the communities in which you have an active relationship with, or feed off them. What's your choice? An engaged, mobilized and participating community can offer you wisdom that you would never know.
Okay.
And for me, I suppose the tipping point for those two things was understanding that I didn't have to have all the answers. But collectively, we have the access to the information and the wisdom to make up those answers. And that was a tipping point.
That's really quite remarkable. We've spoken about wisdom and in the context of how we choose to remove certain channels of wisdom, that's the word I'm looking for, channels of wisdom from our learning. One is community. Another is our elders. Marita, my colleague, and whom we've had on this show, was asking, you know, where are the elders? And that they're in the community. That's where they are. And we choose managers. I'm glad you made that distinction. Managers choose to almost silence certain areas of wisdom because it's not self-serving, to be honest.
Yeah,
I want to protect the patch, actually, the fiefdom, the role, the title. But I think it takes a very conscious leader that has a very open heart and a very open mind to do exactly what you just said.
I'm not quite sure why we fear it. Maybe it's the construct in which we do business in the society today. But I think if you go back to the power of the cooperative, the village looking after the individuals in the village, then how do we actually take the efficiencies, the capabilities, the appropriate disciplines and practices of a commercial, you know, modern environment, but apply it to the fact that we have to raise everyone within our village, and there's those that will always have the ability and the capacity to add value, but they don't have to be a mirror image of me.
Yeah, I like that. And there's something else that you said before with the gent that you worked under. He sounds like a pretty powerful mentor, I guess, someone that could really open you up. And I think I just think about my life and the people that we work with. And it's often these mentors, they come into our world and they've got this ability just to cut through or challenge or provoke, and then they get us out of our head and they kind of open us up. It's almost like they light a fire. Is that something, if you had a lot of strong mentors across your life, if you had people that have come in and out like that?
I've had three really strong mentors. One's my father.
Yep.
And obviously my mum as well, but mum's passed away. But one's my father. Dad has always been someone that provided the opportunity for me to think through my problems and think through my challenges. So we could come up with the solutions, but that was the easiest, simplest and dumbest thing to do. It was about how to actually challenge me in a constructive way that I could actually come up and learn from the experience. The second one was Rob Hunt.
Okay.
And Rob, I have had the opportunity to know for, gosh, over 20, 23 years, and had the opportunity to work with and for him for half of that time. I just think it's a magnificent coincidence that they both share the same birthday.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
A bit of synchronicity there.
And then the last one is a gentleman by the name of Laurie Jensen. I haven't spoken to Laurie for a long time, but when I started working what I consider the professional side of my career,
yeah.
I must have been 21, 22. Laurie was this old gentleman. He must have been 31, 32 or something like that. But Laurie instilled a lot of the disciplines and not the confidence, but the a pathway to really try and do things in a particular format. How to make the complex simple. How to actually win the hearts and minds of people. How to ensure that you're thinking about that intergenerational aspect, not just the immediate short term. What's more than just the transaction and the resume line? What's the legacy that you want to write? And then all of them have that consistency. And I think it's about framing it to provide different lenses for me to consider things. So they would be the three male mentors. The two female mentors, one's my wife, Sue. Sue has been, we've been in, you know, together for 30, 35 years. I better get it right. for the record, 34 years.
Just say it again, we'll edit the right number in.
Thank you very much. 34 and a half years. So, and what Sue has been able to be for me is a sounding board, a mentor, a challenger, an advocate, a critical friend, all kind of roll into one. And then there's a second person who is what I consider to be my millennial mentor because there is an access to resources and capability out there that my prejudice and bias may mean that I don't look at, whereas it's tapping into a different way of thinking.
That's great, Andrew, and I love this sort of reverse mentoring that probably a lot of people don't actually understand the power of that, Jim. You know, when it becomes intergenerational, when you start to really open yourself up to where knowledge or wisdom could come from, the archetypal classic mentor is often someone that's older, but that's only like 50% of the equation.
That's right.
Yeah. Is that something, I mean, this curiosity or this openness, is it something you've always had or something you've always cultivated?
Oh, I've always had a curiosity because I think that and that was brought up through my childhood. Mum and Dad had a business putting up overhead power lines. Okay. So when the contract ran out, we moved. So I think I've been to 11 different schools and lived in 19 different places before the age of 21. So when you went somewhere and you were the new kid or the new person, you had to be curious and learn. And what I absorbed at a very young age was everyone's got a story and everyone's got something to contribute. You just have to ask them.
And then you have to shut up and listen, which is to the other half, isn't it?
Yep.
That's hard. Yep. A lot of people find that very difficult. Yep. I know a lot of people who can ask the question and then keep talking. Isn't that true?
Well and truly.
Yeah. And I think listening, I think you're a great listener. You're a great listener too, Damien.
Oh, thanks, mate.
Listening can only come from listening to ourselves. And I remember a little while ago I sent you an article about solitude. I don't know if you remember that, about solitude and leadership.
It was a cracker. Absolutely.
American scholar. Yes. I think, yeah. Do you do that self-reflection? Do you do a lot of that? Do you practice that solitude?
Yes, I do. Yeah. There's sometimes when, as a leader, your role is to think. Your role is to have that solitude and to challenge or validate what people are telling you and the direction which you're going in. And that's probably the further you go up in organisations and the pointer you are at the leader side, that's a key role. And you don't... There's this tendency to think that in today's world with today's pace and today's information, you have to get it right first up, whereas you don't. We've just been on a path of developing a strategy for the organisation, which I'm Group CEO of, which is a pathway to 2040. Now, that started with discussions with the board in March, and now it's November and we've released it, and we've had probably 6 or 7 iterations with the board and 20, 30 iterations internally. We've had external people challenge us, and what we've got is a very clear understanding that we've now got the ability to operationalise the vision and the intent. But the vision and the intent is defined in only a few number of words, but is the lens which creates that mobilization of the resources and the intellect.
Yeah.
And ours is everybody deserves a home.
Let's talk about that. I'd love to get into housing, affordable housing in the state of Victoria. But you mentioned earlier there is all these crises. There's the rise of nationalism, geopolitical tensions. Almost every minute, you know, we're bombarded with messages, which some we shouldn't turn away from, which I might say. And then there's also the rising cost of living, which, you know, and in the last 12 months, have we had 14 interest rate rises?
We've had a few.
Yeah, 13 or 14. I think I'm pretty close there. And that's starting to impact every small business, every medium-sized business. And now we're seeing cracks in enterprise level as well. Recent news as well. So can we just start there, this rising cost of living? You must be seeing enormous impacts on the ground.
So Haven HomeSafe as an organisation owns or manages around 3,000 homes, which provide for social and affordable and emergency outcomes, and we answer about 25,000 calls for assistance a year. What we've seen in the past 12 months, and I'm not quite sure if the number's correct, but I think it's about 1,500 or 2,000 people contact us who have never contacted us before, ever. So these are people which are hitting stress levels or in vulnerability levels, which puts them to call on a service like Haven. But one of the things that we realise is there is the element around, do you support people through a house or do you support people through the adjunct services and support services? The answer is you actually need to do both in a coordinated manner. But what we don't realise is how big the problem is. Or maybe we spend too much time polishing the problem. And we argue We argue between states and people about what the size of the problem is. I'll give you a blunt instrument. There's about 150,000 people tonight that don't know in Australia where they're going to sleep.
Wow, that's insane.
There's about 600,000 homes short. We argue about the number. Let's just say it's 500,000.
Yeah,
if the average house and land package in Australia or the unit cost is 500,000, we've got a $250 billion problem. So it's $250 billion that we need to have a inclusive, equitable Australia where housing becomes a human right, not a wealth generation vehicle. And if you look at it from that perspective and then stand back and see what's occurring, what we don't have is we've got people looking at it from the $10 or $20 or $30 billion problem rather than the $250 billion problem. So I think we're asking ourselves, we've got the problem defined incorrectly, which means we're then asking ourselves the wrong problems. The wrong question, my apologies. So then what we've got is, how do we mobilise differently? Because we've got a lot of wealth in Australia.
Yes, absolutely.
So how do we mobilise differently? And that's what we're challenging ourselves. And we're an organisation which externally everyone would say is successful and by all traditional measures. But when I look at it, I go, we shouldn't measure the size of our balance sheet. We should measure how many people move to self-determination and the ability to be free of discrimination and able to manage their own pathway. Or how do we actually address the $250 billion problem rather than competing for a $10 billion solution?
What's going to be the game changer here? There's probably more than a handful. There's probably a number of tipping points that will really change this. But otherwise, we're on this train forever, aren't we?
Yeah, so I look at it and go, tipping points, or things that need to change. Firstly, in Australia, we consider real estate ownership as a wealth generation tool. It's actually got to be considered as a human right. That's kind of number one. Number two is the way in which the Australian housing market operates is completely different. We've got different fundamentals and we've got different stresses. We need to own those rather than trying to protect old business models that only accentuate the conflict that we find ourselves in. So we need to realise that there is a different way in which housing is accessed, that how housing ownership is obtained, and what housing stock needs to be. The third one is we love a good flat solution in Australia. Melbourne is an amazing city. But when you look at other cities, when you think about travel, Paris, New York, Madrid, Barcelona, I like Spain, Bologna in Italy, you've got densification done well. You've got urbanisation, not suburbanisation. So you've actually got destination points where communities and villages are created rather than having ones where we lock ourselves in our backyards. Yeah. We've got communities where people are on the streets and intermingling rather than, you know, building a patio and a facility out the back where we don't. The design of the product means that we don't interact.
That's a mindset left over from the mid-20th century, isn't it? That sort of cookie cutter model. Planning model, yeah.
Yes.
Is that? I'm not sure.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's where we've turned the solution because of the floodgate that we've actually had. There was a particular cookie cutter approach.
Yeah.
And it's taken us 40 years to get into this problem, and it'll take us 20, 30 years out of it. But it's got to take inter-political cycle planning and commitment.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, there's this sort of theme that you kind of raised earlier in the chat, Andrew, which is how do we move from the individual to the collective? Now, if we think about, you know, we are community and how I behave affects everyone. So, you know, the level of consciousness I have around my choices is almost fundamental. And are we seeing, you know, through the younger generation, this kind of paradigm shift where people are starting to provoke and ask those questions? What are you seeing as people are coming through your organisation and others?
I actually, although the problem which we're facing from a housing perspective is so enormous, I'm very confident and excited about the generation which is experiencing the problem but will also be part of the solution. What people don't talk about at the moment is we will have the largest transfer of intergenerational wealth in human history as baby boomers start to
you're going to put it this very politically correct start to leave this place
so then that wealth will transfer to people which I believe will make greater value-based decisions than potentially just wealth-based decisions. And I think how that capital is actually applied, whether it is for more community-based or global-based outcomes, I have some faith in that.
Yeah, so do I. Actually, I was just reflecting on, was listening to Radio National this morning about younger people in their 25 and younger, protesting a war. And there was a school, what do they call it? The school shut. The students didn't go to school the other day. And they went and protested for the Palestinian cause. And there was a narrative on Radio National this morning about how we need to encourage young people to have a voice, to have an opinion. And we have to elevate and empower them for this very reason, because we can't stop them advocating for the things they're passionate about, because in a couple of years they'll be voting, and if we quash them and try to make them conform to the baby boomer way of thinking, to connect the dots here, they're going to grow up disenfranchised, disconnected, and very angry. And we don't want that.
So when I look at it and go, as a business leader, I'm entering the twilight part of my career.
No.
Yeah. Or maybe not. I'll just write different chapters. But the thing which I see is, what is the active role that I play to enable the future leaders to participate in the strategy and in the vision and in the implementation of that? So I think, and how do we create safe environments for people to have a voice and have an opinion and have a direction? And it's okay. I know that, you know, you pick up any management book or any leadership book and it says, you know, fail fast, and all that.
Yeah.
But it's okay to make mistakes. Some of my biggest learnings have been through mistakes, but I've been mentored and supported through them. And I've seen other people make mistakes, which has enabled me to actually learn from that as well. I have a good day if I only make 20 mistakes a day. so that's okay.
That's very rare. That's very rare. I work with a lot of leaders and you're probably one of the very few who would openly just say that. And actually, I know it's true, right? Mm. I firsthand know it's true. And I've been in the room when you've called yourself up. I've been there. I've witnessed it, you know, in front of 50 other people and owned that. And it was very inspiring to see. But it's a minority, isn't it?
Thank you. I don't see it. I just see it as good behaviour. I just see it as, well, what I expect.
Mm.
And I see it as something which reflects what I think is an underrated leadership trait, which is humility.
Yeah, I agree. And I want to connect some other dots on the point of humility. At the beginning of our conversation, we talked about essentially business model change, moving to the cooperative or the value creation business model as opposed to creation for shareholders. And then later in our conversation, we talked about systemic change, especially around housing and the systemic change that needs to occur, especially in here in Victoria, to solve this housing crisis. And to solve that, we need to change mindsets and business models. Let's come back to humility now. Business model to a business owner, speaking as one, is hyper-connected to you as an individual. So the way a business functions and makes money, its funding, its philanthropy, its operations, the people who own the business or are directors of the business, and I'm posing this question to you, Andrew, both as a CEO and as a director, you're closely tied to that business model. Enter humility. When we ask you to change something that you are closely tied to, and when I mean by closely tied, there's ego, there's our very frail human personalities. We aren't those brave, wonderful, beautiful animals sitting on that 4-kilometre ice shelf.
Yeah.
We are not that. We are this speck, right? This is so much of us are embedded here. There's also, I'm pointing to my watch, the time is running out, so we've got to go and cook dinner, and there's all that. Changing that fundamental thing at the core of a business, the way it makes money, the way it functions, the role of the individual, which is protected. I want to keep my job. I like being the CEO. I worked hard to get to this role. I'm not going to rock the boat. Humility is real. I agree with you 100%. But I'd like to then discuss the fact that humility is fucking hard because we come up against this. Change. Fundamental change. Change the way you make money. Change where the money flows. How the money flows. How the funding happens. How and who sits in the chair and how often and how long. All of that needs to be thrown up. So humility is really noble and I'm all for it, but I've also seen how difficult it can be.
Good question, Jim. Is your question to Andrew, how do you keep that humility and integrity with all of that stakeholder pressure when you're trying to, you know, take an organization through a change process? That can't be easy because you've got investment pressure, ecosystem pressure, board pressure, stakeholder pressure, and then you're trying to bring them on an innovation journey. Like that's not going to be easy.
Now it's my turn to bring a few things together.
Please.
So in a heightened situation where we either have fear or risk, we tend to become myopic. And the challenge, I think, for a leader is to keep people to focus on the light on the hill and the pathway to get there.
Yeah.
Mm.
I said to someone the other day, and if she's listening to this, she'll probably laugh. I said, the difference between how you view the problem and I view the problem is, my definition of the problem is, we've got to get to Sydney. Your definition of the problem is, what do I pack in my suitcase to get to Sydney?
Okay.
And it's not even Sydney. I'm just thinking, do I go by train, car or plane? So I think the role of the leader is to ensure that we provide the lens or the lenses by which people can constantly evaluate in a safe environment the destination and the understanding the why. We often revert to telling people what to do or how to do it and don't spend the time saying why do we do it. So there has to be a connection between the values of the organisation, because I think people work for an organisation for only three reasons. The first reason is they want to belong to something bigger than what they can do and achieve by themselves. So it's very critical for you as a leader to be able to explain the why so people can resonate and belong to that why. If you don't, then you've missed an opportunity. The second one is people, I believe, want to be recognised for the value which they create and want to have an opportunity to contribute. A lot of people say that my leadership style is I create environments for people to contribute and feel empowered to make decisions. And that's a mixture of a couple of things. It's a mixture of the pace in which businesses I've worked in the past have operated, so I can't make every decision. But it also gets people to tie themselves into the business and the values and what you're trying to achieve. So if you marry those together, it's about the why. It's about the lenses that which you can constantly ensure that the organisation remains on track. And it's about understanding that there's more than one stakeholder in the equation.
Mm.
And I think I've made a lot of money in my career for faceless individual in institutional funds overseas. But I believe that it's having that broader understanding of wealth creation that is critically important. Knowing that this is just a chat between friends, there's a couple of things which I keep myself aligned. One of them is I talk about outcome over ownership. A lot of businesses want to own things. Leaders want to own things. Where we should actually be concentrating on what's the outcome that we're trying to achieve. And that may mean me giving up control or giving up ownership to get something. So it's outcome over ownership is a big lens for me. The second one is wealth over profit. And we often measure things by return on equity or return on capital invested or whatever it is, age-old formulas, where I actually look at what's the wealth that we're creating in all forms of capital beyond just the financial capital. They're two really critical things for me. And then the last one is it's development over growth. So we actually talk about growth targets a lot in businesses. Whereas I want to know how have we developed as an organisation our capacity and capability so that we have the flexibility and adaptability for an unknown and uncertain future. Because just getting to the goalpost doesn't mean you've won the game. And that's a critical thing. So they're kind of three lenses which I've kind of built as critical things for me over the past.
Yeah, that's really powerful.
10 or 20 years.
That's really powerful. Damien?
I was just, when I think about the theme through what you're talking is, there's such a strong human focus in what you're talking about, because it's about all the intrinsic human drivers, and it's about bringing the people along. And that's not easy when when you're looking at growth targets or data targets or you're answering to a board. And so I'm just really quite fascinated by how you integrate and balance both of those, because we live in the real world. We still have to deliver. Yeah, we have to deliver value. The value could be commercial. Well, value is commercial, but how do you keep those two buckets or those two worlds balanced in a way that kind of still represents your ethics and the broader values and ethics of the organisation? Because that can't always be that easy.
People so often focus on the mechanics and not the dynamics.
Okay.
So they focus on things that are measurable and comfortable to them.
Yeah.
You can achieve the mechanical and goal outcomes whilst doing it in a collective and collaborative way. I look at it and say, I'm quite comfortable to walk into the meeting and say, here's the Sydney.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure how we get there. Got any thoughts? And pose the questions to mobilise it. Quite often, we use the intellect the skills, the capability and the commitment of our organisation and at the communities and the ecosystems in which we operate, we use those last.
Mm.
Well, that's pretty stupid because then we actually don't have all the information to make wise decisions. And I don't make all the decisions. And Dimitri, you've been in meetings where you've actually seen me say, oh, I think we should go left. Then someone will say something and I say, oh, that makes sense, we should go right.
Yeah.
And then someone will say something else and I say, oh, maybe we should stand still. What do you reckon? And I think it's that having the ability to facilitate and draw people in. Sometimes the greatest wisdom comes from the last person that's talking that's been the quietest and they've just been an absorbing thing and you think that they're actually on their phone scrolling through their texts, where what they're doing is they're thinking and acting differently to how I would. We all have our own processes to add value.
There's a real, thank you for acknowledging that, there's a real sense of selflessness and humility in accepting diverse perspectives and then being open in front of the people you work with and are accountable to change your mind.
Hmm. I had the opportunity to be in front of an organisation as the new CEO and we were doing a transformation and I was questioned by the organisation whether the transformation, the ability for the organisation to co-design the new organisation was real or whether it was just fake and we were just, we already had the answer. And fundamentally, we had our Sydney defined, but we didn't have anything else. And I stood up and I said into that organisation, let me tell you why I'm asking the organisation to co-design and why it's not already done. I said, I've been new to this organisation and I've made many decisions and here's two which I've gotten wrong. Mm. And I got them wrong because I did not consider or ask for the input of the organisation. Now, it doesn't mean that you will make the decision, but you can inform the decision. You have a role in participating in the debate. And sometimes that will change things, sometimes it won't. But I don't make the right decision all the time.
I think it's really refreshing to hear. And it's why I think even my experience knowing you, Andrew, in the last 5 years or so, I've learnt so much and I've been in a lot of those transformation meetings and I've heard those questions being asked of you actually. And it's really a wonderful thing to witness, Damien, to see, just to see that selflessness is really quite remarkable. While we're talking about Haven Home Safe, I'd love to hear how, and I've been party to a lot of the development that you've experienced over the last 5 years. How would you describe the organization's development as opposed to its growth over the last 5 years? And what does 2040 look like for Haven Home Safe?
Haven as an organisation has done absolutely amazing things. It started in Bendigo as a provider of support services to members of the union and has grown from there. Its previous CEO, Ken Marchingo, grew the organisation through three or four discrete phases of opportunity and growth, always trying to meet demand in a integrated and supported way. I think, and through that, the way in which things have been operated, it's been accessing government funding, and it's been a heavy reliance on working, with, for, and through community. I think what we're looking to do from Haven is twofold. It's how can we be fit for purpose and fit for future. We've grown year on year for 20, 30 years. And what we're doing is really holding up a mirror to ourselves to say, how can we be more efficient and effective with the scale that we've got and the resources and the capability and capacity? How can we ensure that we go from great to greater?
Mm.
And that's in itself is a piece of activity and work, but that's what we need to do to be more efficient and effective with the limited resources which we have available to us. The fit for future is how do we design new forms of ecosystems? For the first time, I think, in the history of affordable housing associations, we've got more access to different forms of capital than we've ever had previously. So it's how do we mobilise that and be a deliverer of government policy, a deliverer of social expectation, a deliverer of community outcomes, a deliverer of the ability for people to own and have a place to call home. And for me, I think what we're doing is blending the responsibility of a socially impactful organisation in the communities in which we have a relationship and operate, but also challenge ourselves to be, how do we access different forms of commercial mindset to help us with our social vision. So I believe what we're really doing is accelerating and enhancing the fact that we are a community and socially impactful and oriented business, but applying commercial orientation and disciplines to help us deliver our remit at scale, because there is a necessity to do it at scale. And then if we can do it, then what we would love to do is to publish the recipe and let everyone else...
Yep.
It's not about IP protection. Mm. This is about how do we learn from it, and then how can other people do it. So how do we de-risk the opportunity? Not a certainty, but a higher level of guarantee.
Yeah, that resonated because I remember I was in the room and when the penny dropped a few years ago, and this is more comment for Damien, I was in the room when the penny dropped when... Someone mentioned, or the discussion was being had, that we have to see our competition as potential partners. I remember that moment. It was in one of the board meetings. And it was this penny drop moment where the conversation went from, you know, at 5 out of 10 to 11 out of 10 all of a sudden. It was really fascinating. And I think that's one of the pathways there, isn't it? It's partnering and collaborating and sharing IP.
Yeah. So if I... when I look at it, if you've got a $250 billion problem, then your competition is not other housing associations.
No.
Your competition is the fact that we've got 400,000 or 500,000 homes short. That's the problem. So that's why I say we've got to figure out what the right things to focus on. And that's a change in mindset and a change in focus.
Yeah, it's, I guess what you're asking us to think about, Andrew, is a lot of people that are in a leadership position and thinking about your story and how you're bringing this the organization forward, is it's like, how do we really provoke, agitate, challenge, break down that myopic kind of thinking? Like, how do we, I mean, there's, you're almost talking about this formula for being able to do that, which is, unless we start thinking about the collective, unless we start thinking about impact, if it's bigger than me, then almost it's like I'll drive through those problems. But if it's just about me and the board or my return on investment, then I'm just not going to find the gears.
So I've got a fundamental belief that markets only change for two reasons. Markets change because of a new technology. Yeah. So if you think electricity, steam engine, there's some dramatic changes to how things were produced and where people invested. Car, etc. Or they change because of government intervention, positively or negatively. It's either a tax or it's an incentive. Otherwise, markets will want to sweat their deployed assets and their previous business models or current business models for as long as possible.
Mm.
The challenge which we need to do is to figure out how to change in that environment and how to work with government and policy and market participants to act differently in that. And I think what we've got to do is to be able to translate, and I think our role is to provide the opportunity to translate new ecosystems and the new mobilization of existing players within market. But we've got to do it. I think the new technology change will be IP. It's how do you actually talk to them about the intellectual property that you can use to get people to change.
Sorry, please go.
No, sorry, go, Jim. But I was going to say, like, the formulas, the methods, the strategies, and how do you then release that to the world? Because when I release that to others, they're just going to iterate. They're going to design something better, and then someone else will design something better. So we're all going to come along.
Isn't that a great thing?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, well, that's where the game changing happens, doesn't it? Because you're letting go.
Exactly right. Mm. Sometimes the best way to get your outcome is to give up control.
Yeah.
And if you can be the magnesium flare, or if you can be that guiding light, then that's a great thing.
Yeah, that's the path to impact.
That's a path to impact.
Absolutely. And the one major barrier is the individualism at the heart of that organization that's holding on to their fiefdom. That's the barrier, isn't it?
It is.
Which impacts the market.
It is. But so there is the mechanics. I go back to the mechanics and the dynamics. You must be able to address the fundamentals of market requirements. Otherwise, you don't have sustainability. You have to you give a pathway to address risk and opportunity. That's what I consider to be the seat at the table. The dynamics is to get people engaged and motivated and excited and committed to a different way of doing things. That there is an understanding of how to connect the dots. Making the complex simple, making it understanding what the true value creation is, understanding your value proposition, but also everyone understanding their role and what they play and what their return will be.
And you're surrounded by some great people there at Haven the Home Safe. So I imagine that would be your day-to-day experience at the moment. You're mobilising, you're galvanising people.
Yep, and we're trying things and we won't get them all. But what we will do is be in, if we can get the change of thinking, then we can get a change of solutions and we can get a change of behaviour. Then we can actually start to get people not to concentrate on how to mobilise $10 or $20 billion of the problem, but how do we mobilise $200 billion of the problem.
Yeah. Well, we've been going for an hour.
Oh, have we really?
Yeah. So
we could talk all day.
We could. Yeah. Oh,
that's been
well, a fast
you.
Hour.
Yeah. Thank you very much for the opportunity. It's been wonderful
to have you here, Andrew. It's been. I saw parallels actually, Damien, to our first Reg Crawford conversation. Reg told us a lot of stories. Very different field, Rwanda and Afghanistan. I saw some parallels there in the way the two of you actually use those moments to reflect, and you're very reflective. I think the parallels between Reg and Andrew, I think that's really powerful learning.
Yeah, you're right, Jim. And you know, as I reflect on this conversation, Andrew, there was a real, there's a real strong provocation to how we think. There's a strong provocation to, mate, we can do good business and we can retain our humanity and we can create really great impact in the world. So why should they be exclusive? It doesn't make any sense because we're all going to suffer.
I think business without, you know, what was it, Gandhi's seven sins, and I'm all going to get them wrong, but the one was business without ethics, you know, politics without principles.
I won't try.
Wealth without work. Yeah. I think there's science without humanity. There's a number of ones there, which I just think you reflect on those and you go, and Dimitri, I got them all wrong as well, but they're the ones which I think are lenses to ensure that when we judge, when we reflect on the path in which we're doing and that shadow, I think that's probably another learning which I had is the understanding that your shadow as a leader has on the organisation and the culture. It's really important that you're living that and holding yourself accountable as well. And it's okay to maybe not always do it, not always be on message, but you've got to know when you're off message and call yourself out on it.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, special. That's right.
That's really special. Andrew, thank you so much.
Thanks, Andrew.
Damien, cheers. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Damien Carolla, and I've been playing in the human development and high performance space for a few decades now and run a coaching practice called Mentor Hub. And I work with entrepreneurs, athletes, CEOs, and leaders on the topics of change and transformation, leadership, and culture. What's central to my work is that we create safe, empowering, and inspiring spaces for people to realise their potential. And I work with leaders and organisations across a diverse range of sectors, from building, construction, and technology, through to retail and social enterprise. You know, lately I've been collaborating with leaders and teams around the topics of mental resilience and agility. You know, we use a lot of storytelling, open dialogue to help leaders and teams redefine what it means to build resilience and flexibility across a chaotic world. I believe in the power of the human condition and that each one of us is here to realise our full potential. And so Fearless Conversations is a series of dialogue sessions where we get to peel back the layers and really explore the things that matter most. It's a conversation between two good friends that care deeply about people and the worlds in which we live.
Hi, I'm Jim Antonopoulos. Actually, my name is Dimitri, but we'll get into that another time. I'm the Managing Director of Strategy and Transformation Consultancy, Tank. We're based in Melbourne, Australia. As one of Australia's earliest B Corp accredited businesses, we work across a number of impact areas of change and transformation programs, empowering young women, sustainable and affordable housing, financial literacy for underrepresented communities, accessible quality education, meaningful workplace cultures, and cultural diversity and inclusion being some of them. My team and I bring empathy and meaning to impact organisations, and we believe that every business and every leader can be good, ethical, and purpose-driven, or at least they should be. Most importantly, I'm a father of three amazing people, and I work tirelessly to leave the world in a better place for them. Our podcast continues thanks to your support. Listeners like you who have shared our podcast with your networks on LinkedIn and other social platforms have meant the world to us. It has motivated us to continue doing what we do. If you would like to support this podcast and keep it free of advertising forever, please head on over to marchfirst.com.au/podcast, where you can donate to support our show and share the link with your friends and network.